You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, April 12th, 2023. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Aris Camporozos Athanasio, author of Speculative Communities, Living with Uncertainty in the Financialized World. And then later in the program, Nathan Tankus will be joining us to discuss the Fed and all of its issues. Meanwhile, blue states like California, New York, Massachusetts, and more stockpiling abortion pills in the wake of the insane ruling in Texas. A Pew poll finds that support for the legality of the abortion pill in their state, in people's own states, it's more than 2-1. Last month, inflation was the lowest since 2021, over a year. But the IMF warns of a potential coming recession with the rapid interest rate hikes by the Fed. Memphis commissioners will decide today whether to reinstate the second lawmaker, Justin Pearson, expelled over gun control protests prior to a special election being held. Justin Jones was reinstated yesterday. The Louisville shooter who murdered five people bought his AR-15 legally, police say. Calls grow for Dianne Feinstein's resignation as her repeated absences continue to throw a wrench in the nominating process for judges, which is very important given what we're seeing with abortion and more. The EPA has rolled out its new proposed rules to get 2/3 of cars and 1/4 of new heavy trucks to be fully electric by 32. We're in 2023. Damn it. The Biden administration has also proposed cutting water allotments to the rapidly shrinking Colorado River, which multiple states and tribes rely upon. The squad led by Rashida Tlaib have signed a letter asking the Biden administration to drop charges against Julian Assange. More on that in a second. The judge in the Dominion lawsuit has once again ruled against Fox News, saying that they cannot use the argument that the voter fraud conspiracies were newsworthy. Russia tightens its conscription laws in order to force more Russians into the war of aggression in Ukraine. And lastly, Alvin Bragg suing Jim Jordan over his attack on the DA's investigation into Trump. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. How you doing? Hope all is well. It is hump day. It is hump day. I'm contractually obligated to tell you as such. And once again, it's a two-hander with myself, Bradley Alsop, the ESVN duo, except just also on the Majority Report. I was surprised to see, just quick sports thing, that the Hawks dismantled. We didn't even get to talk about this before the show. We'll talk about it later. But that was I'm bummed about the Heat losing.
Not my strongest prediction there.
Yeah, not mine either. But yeah, playoffs ramping up. Check out ESVN. Plug for that at the start of the show. How about that? I make the rules.
Do whatever we want.
Oh yeah.
Commerce.
Rebels, baby. I wanted to open with this because it's really important. Representative Rashida Tlaib has led an effort to, she led this effort here, and a lot of other members of the squads signed it, to get the DOJ to drop charges against Julian Assange. There were others in this letter. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez signed it. Greg Kaysar, who is a new kind of squad member from Texas. Jamal Bowman, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, all of the usual good suspects, signed this letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland, who, you know, I always call him the ghost. You never see him. He really is not at the forefront of the Biden administration's plans. I wish, obviously, that the Democrats would take a page out of the Republicans' book and be a bit more aggressive when they hold power in the executive branch, but regardless, so who knows if he'll even read this, but they are asking him to drop charges against Julian Assange. Here's this letter. Let's put this up. Rashida Tlaib says, 4 years ago today, Julian Assange was arrested for publishing the truth. I'm leading a letter to Attorney General Garland urging him to uphold the freedom of the press by dropping these Trump-era charges and withdrawing the extradition request. The letter says, Dear Attorney General Merrick Garland, we write to you today to call on you to uphold the First Amendment's protections for the freedom of the press by dropping the criminal charges against Australian publisher Julian Assange and withdrawing the American extradition request currently pending with the British government. Press freedom, civil liberty, and human rights groups have been emphatic that the charges against Mr. Assange pose a grave and unprecedented threat to everyday constitutionally protected journalistic activity, and that a conviction would represent a landmark setback for the First Amendment. She lists some media outlets that are asking for the withdrawal, ACLU, Amnesty International, and more. Let's go to the next page. The prosecution of Julian Assange for carrying out journalistic activities greatly diminishes America's credibility as a defender of these values, undermining the United States' moral standing on the world stage and effectively granting cover to authoritarian governments who can and do point to Assange's prosecution to reject evidence-based criticisms of their human rights records as a precedent that justifies the criminalization of reporting on their activities. Leaders of democracies, major international bodies, and parliamentarians around the globe stand opposed to the prosecution of Julian Assange, former United Nations. So more and more people, Obrador, Lula, a bunch of other leaders who have said that this prosecution should stop. There is a global outcry, as she writes. And then just the there's a bunch of citations. Here we go. Julian Assange faces 17 charges under the Espionage Act and one charge of conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. The Espionage Act charges stem from Mr. Assange's role in publishing information about the U.S. State Department, Guantanamo Bay, and wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Much of this information was published by mainstream newspapers, such as the New York Times and Washington Post, who often worked with Mr. Assange and WikiLeaks directly in doing so. This is such a key point. Based on the legal logic of this indictment, any of those newspapers could be prosecuted for engaging in these reporting activities. In fact, because what Mr. Assange is accused of doing is legally indistinguishable from what papers like the New York Times do, the Obama administration rightfully declined to bring these charges. The Trump administration, which is, by the way, shocking given the Obama administration's absolute love for prosecuting people under the Espionage Act. The Trump administration, which brought these charges against Assange, was notably less concerned with press freedom. This is, by the way, good framing here because it appeals to the sensibilities of the Biden administration with that framing. But this final slide here, and then we'll just discuss. So here we go. Rashida Tlaib, Cori Bush, I should have mentioned her earlier, Greg K. Sarge, Jamal Bowman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and others have signed this letter. So this is a really awesome thing to do here because there's no political value in it. You know, I was engaging with concepts of popularism yesterday and today on social media, and like, there are limits, and I actually think it's quite a limiting belief to say we're only going to do what's popular. We're only going to advocate what's popular as a party for electoral purposes. Well, we've talked on the show at length about the limits of electoralism because it is shallow, flimsy, and it's not conducive to building long-lasting power in coalitions. What it also does too is it drastically limits the scope of what's possible. and what you can advocate for on the left. Martin Luther King had a 75% disapproval rating the year he was killed in 1968. By the standards of popularism, the civil rights movement should not have happened because it wasn't too popular at the time. Gay marriage, not popular at the time when it was being advocated for initially, and people were trying to fight for those rights. And then that went up and up and up until, you know, Democratic politicians, notably Biden, I guess on the Ellen show, started advocating for it. But the activist groups did the work of making that position popular. And Julian Assange, not the most popular guy in Washington, not the most popular guy if you were to ask people who even know of him in the United States, which I would guess is not the majority. He was DMing with Don Jr. and doing other things that people might consider shady. And obviously there have been allegations against him that are problematic. I don't particularly care because that's not relevant to what we're talking about here. What WikiLeaks uncovered was war crimes by the United States. The most infamous, and Chelsea Manning went to prison over this. The most infamous was the nearly 40-minute video of a U.S. Apache helicopter raining bullets down in Iraq, killing just dozens of people for fun, laughing as they did it, including two Reuters journalists. That's a war crime. By any definition of the word. And we're going after the guy that helped disseminate that information publicly? And there was more stuff. It was the images of torture. It was information about friendly fire in these wars of aggression by the United States. It was about the United States' relationship with other leaders in Afghanistan and the Taliban and their kind of shady dealings behind the scenes in order to maintain the occupation. And war there, which we all know went on for way too long. So, like, the value of this information when the U.S. empire was engaged in such indefensible acts abroad, killing God knows how many people. I mean, hundreds of thousands in Iraq. I mean, hundreds of thousands in Afghanistan. We don't know the full scope. The fact that we have this information is incredibly valuable. And thankfully, Chelsea Manning has been released after being placed multiple times in solitary confinement and tortured, essentially, for daring to blow the whistle on the war crimes committed by the United States. And that letter is correct. What Julian Assange did is indistinguishable from what the Times or the Washington Post do in or should be doing. The problem is that they are not at the forefront of these things. They're afraid about this kind of exposure, but prosecuting WikiLeaks for these crimes, or crimes, in quotes, does, as they say, open up more legacy outlets for prosecution. And we've done this dance since the war on terror started. We're not going to put legal guardrails in place when Democrats get into office, when Obama or Biden get elected, because they want the option to use the powers of the war on terror for their own ends. But the problem with doing that is that it ensures that a guy like Trump can come in and use basically Obama's own logic under the Espionage Act for his own purposes and go after Julian Assange and have unlimited power in that area. So this is the right thing to do. I'm thrilled to see progressive members of Congress take up this mantle, and good on them. Glad to see it. And clearly the charges against Julian Assange should be dropped. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. But first, we have a word or two. There we go. From our sponsors. Mother's Day is coming up. Just a reminder, it's time to start getting something for your mom or someone in your life who is a mom. Really important. Make Mother's Day extra special for your loved one this year. You can get a unique, heartfelt gift that will make her feel truly special and loved, and that is the gift of StoryWorth. Now, I haven't used this for Mother's Day, but I have used this for Father's Day, and I will say, it's loved. StoryWorth, hugely popular in my family. StoryWorth is an online service that helps you and your loved ones preserve precious memories and stories for years to come, a meaningful gift that connects you to those who matter most. It's really creative and cool because every week StoryWorth will email your loved one a thoughtful, thought-provoking question of your choice from their vast pool of options. These are questions that you may never have thought to ask or had the chance to ask your loved one, like what is the bravest thing you've ever done in your life, or if you could see into the future, what would you want to find out? I mean, just stories of their childhood, stories about their college days or high school days or how they met their significant other. After 1 year, StoryWorth will then compile these stories, including photos, into a beautiful keepsake book that you'll be able to share and revisit for generations to come. Not to get too schmaltzy, but I was really close with my grandmother growing up. She was from Finland. She immigrated here. She was a hairdresser. She worked at, Macy's, and she did the hairdresser for Ginger from, she did the hair for Ginger from Gilligan's Island. Like, I only knew that from my mom telling me. And when I was a teenager, when she died, and I really, really would have loved to have stories of, like, how her struggle to immigrate here, what it was like, basically, you know, living in the United States on the poverty line as an immigrant and the different jobs that she had to make ends meet. I wish that I had a more comprehensive kind of book like this to remember her by. You can be proactive about this with StoryWorth. So StoryWorth for Mother's Day, it really is a great idea. Again, I've got it for my dad, and my family really, really does appreciate it. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift that you'll cherish for years, StoryWorth. Right now, for a limited time, you will save $10 on your first purchase when you go to StoryWorth.com/majority. That's StoryWorth.com/majority to save $10 on your first purchase. StoryWorth, that's StoryWorth.com/majority. Save $10 off, and don't forget, Mother's Day's coming up. I know it can creep up on you, but this is a really good and heartfelt option for that. And you know what else is coming up? It's coming up next week. 420. 420, baby. And Sunset Lake Sebede is having a sale. All products will be 30% off with the coupon code 420. And orders over $150 will get a free 20-count jar of gummies, Sour Bears, Good Vibe gummies, or Sleep gummies. The Sleep gummies, I take them every night, basically. If I run out or I forget to pick up some from the office and I'm like, damn, it's empty, I'm not happy about it. These are great products. I also use this body lotion because my skin's been really dry recently. It's helped a ton. I just have been having like allergic reactions to dust, getting some hives on my arms and stuff. That soothes it. It really does. And if you end up getting Sunset Lake during this time, 5% of all proceeds will be donated to the Last Prisoner Project. And MR, we will match the donations, Sunset Lake's donations to the Last Prisoner Project. The Last Prisoner Project helps prisoners through legal intervention, direct constituent support, advocacy campaigns, and policy change. We are teaming up to turn 420, the classic stoner holiday, into a fundraiser for that organization, the Last Prisoner Project. They're a nonprofit organization dedicated to cannabis criminal justice, so this all connects. So here's how it works. Starting today, everything on sunsetlakesebede.com will be 30% off with the coupon code 420. And orders over $150, as I mentioned, you get a free jar of gummies of your choice included with all the orders. I would recommend those damn sleep gummies. This is Sunset Lake's biggest sale of the year, and it ends on April 23rd. Don't miss it. Head on over to sunsetlakecbd.com to take advantage of this deal and help raise money for cannabis criminal justice reform. A reminder that MR will match the Sunset Lake donations on this front to the Last Prisoner Project. Some restrictions apply. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Aris. are joined now by Aris Camporosos, Athanasio, author of Speculative Communities, Living with Uncertainty in a Financialized World. Aris is also a professor of sociology at the University of College London. Thank you so much, Aris, for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Of course. So how would you define the term speculative communities?
Okay, so
I start very broad, and then we dig deeper.
No, that's good. I ought to, and you know, this is a question that I get a lot. And having written a whole book about it, I should be able to answer it in a few simple words. I'll have a go. So, essentially, by speculative communities, I mean I refer to groups of people that come together, they form bonds, they connect to each other. On the basis of a shared condition, a shared encounter, we can say, with a world that is radically uncertain. So what unites those groups, those people, isn't necessarily a shared coherent narrative or, things that have a shared symbolic value, let's say, you know, necessarily a nation or, family or traditional political party membership and so on, but rather a feeling, an imaginary of sharing this uncertain condition that they're all faced with a very unknown, unknowable future. They're in the throes of this chaos and they are together. And so all they have to do to survive is to speculate on that future. That's one way to answer at least this.
Well, I would imagine that it's very different. I mean, and by imagine, I know it is quite different than like the economic portrayal of speculation. And yours is clearly more sociological. Economics is often treated like a religion when clearly it's just one tool or one arrow in a quiver, if you will, of history, sociology, philosophy, even if you want to go down that road, although the abstraction of that sometimes frustrates me. But like your sociological definition seems to kind of try to wrap its arms around the connection and not the kind of two-dimensional economic vision of, say, speculation.
Yeah, I think you put it very well there. I guess the origins of the term and of the project itself lie in my own frustration with the discipline of economics. I must confess I'm a trained economist. That was what I studied for my undergraduate degree. I have since taken quite a long kind of U-turn. But I have found myself back as a sociologist interested in those questions around how economists imagine the world, imagine the future, and how they seek to intervene in very problematic ways. And so, yes, speculation in the world of economics means something very specific. It has a long history in how it's deployed. It has a moral connotation as well. There is a moral debate about what constitutes legitimate speculation in economics. So, you know, economists often think of speculation as something that fulfills a positive function in society, in that it takes unwanted risk off the hands of those that can't afford to take on that risk. So there is a kind of, there is space, there should be space for speculation, we hear, right? But of course, from my perspective, I wanted to do a couple of things. I wanted to move away from a more deterministic definition of speculation that is, you know, taking risk and gambling on assets and asset prices to a more imaginative act that we increasingly find ourselves in a position of taking, an act of an open-ended, an act that betrays a more open-ended engagement with our uncertain futures. So yes, it is, I think there is something, I'm trying to look at speculation from a slightly different perspective, from the perspective of the imagination, if you like. What is imaginative about speculation? And also what is collective, as we started? What makes us do it together in ways that are non-economistically deterministic?
Yeah, I mean, and the kind of spread of speculation that you speak about also has its ramifications felt in the political spectrum, in political speculation. I mean, we're a political show, so that is kind of what piqued my interest in particular. But you make the case, really, that the global instability in the 21st century, and even back before that, really, but particularly the 2008 crisis, Brexit, the rise of Trump, obviously, even Narendra Modi in India, like how there is speculation and gambling embedded in the coalition behind them. I hadn't heard that put that way before, and I really liked it. Can you expand on that part of your thesis here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a very important part of the argument I put forward, which is that in a world, especially the post-2008 financial crisis world, where a lot of these big political shakeups are taking place, a lot of folks' patience or belief in the promise of neoliberal capitalism seems to be betrayed. You know, there is this rise of global waves of, you know, populism. Trump, Brexit are cases that I look at in the book, but as you said, you know, India, the Philippines, Brazil, you know, Israel, so many cases of this brand of rather chaotic mix of populist politics is on the rise. And so what I think characterizes, what kind of underpins this brand of populism on the rise is, yes, on the one hand, a kind of straightforward nationalism, a kind of right-wing regressive politics that is shares elements with the past. But there is also a new element of a more speculative engagement with the volatility of the political landscape. And rather than attempting to control the narrative and offer narratives of security to voters, let's say, there seems to be an attempt to weaponize that volatility, to even cultivate it further for political gain. You know, the example that is very folks might immediately think of here, the origins often of this type of politics are placed in Putin's advisor, Surkov. Like he wrote this manifesto, I don't know if you might recall it, about how essentially there's no need to control the narrative, but obfuscating it and throwing more and more information to confuse, that is real, the greatest political weapon one can have. And so that, in a sense, what I describe as speculative politics, and this is the kind of landscape that we have and we have had over the last over a decade or so globally.
Your contention is that, like, the nationalism in response to globalism, to characterize these leaders at least, that is too simple, that there is a chaos kind of thrust into our everyday lives that has, like, really been a function of the rampant speculation in, like, the highly financialized world that makes people feel like it's almost anti-society, nothing matters, impulse that is embedded in that kind of nationalistic framework. So it characterizes it a bit differently.
Yeah, so a few things here. I mean, I think you're right to say that there is something. I think you're pointing to the cynicism of this.
That's the word I was looking for. Yes,
which is certainly true. I mean, there is something fatalistic, right? Something about just throwing oneself into chaos as a response to the growing uncertainty that surrounds us. So two things that I should say here. I'm talking here about, as again, you yourself just mentioned, a growth of what we call financialization of everyday life. So following this is something that has been going on for a few decades, but intensified even after the financial crisis. So the extent to which our everyday life decisions are dictated by financial questions, and the extent to which culturally also the way we consider ourselves, our choices of partners, our choices of home, our education are being articulated in financial terms. And so my argument is that we are being nursed into the speculative environment. And so our very way of imagining the future becomes speculative, right? And so to go to the question of populist speculation and Trump and Brexit, when we try to understand why folks vote for Trump vote Brexit, to offer the answer, to explain that vote only on the base of the attraction of the nationalist, of the strength of nationalism, the pull of nationalism, that is, nationalism is what? It's stability. You know, it's a security, the symbolic security we have about belonging to a nation. But to exhaust this analysis there, for me, is problematic because precisely of that speculative way of imagining that has been so pervasive in our time. And what does that mean? It means that when Trump was doing his grotesque governed by chaos and waging war against the bureaucrats of the public service, civil service, and doing the trade wars and so on. This cultivation of chaos has an openness. It doesn't bring stability, right? It's a narrative that is all over the place. And yet it seems to be reflecting the condition of uncertainty that we already are familiar with. So it seems more honest, it seems more authentic, more representative of our reality, our experienced reality, than a promise of stability that might be voiced, let's say, by the liberal elites that are responsible for those very conditions of uncertainty. So does that make sense? So there are these two sides of that coin, right? There is the stability, the security of nationalism, but there is also the open-endedness of this chaos that is taken advantage of, and it is intentionally sort of weaponized by those forces, the regressive forces.
Yeah, and that is embedded in just the trolling element of, oh my gosh, that makes me really want an espresso. I cannot. I'm already drinking way too much coffee, but that looks great.
I know. I shouldn't be drinking. It's my fourth or fifth one, but anyway.
you have a stronger stomach than me, I guess. But putting that aside, it does kind of feed both human impulses in that way and politically. And I mean, I also wonder about the, you talk about enclosure a lot in your book and how the increased kind of financial speculation is, works in tandem, with enclosure. I also wonder how much the lack of public space and the enclosure on that front kind of fuels this, where you become more atomized. And so the risk, it's kind of untethered from any practical realities or communal realities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think this is now a very... it's a delicate and interesting matter here, how social space changes through financial speculation. I think what I try to do, the way I would put it, is that what is going on isn't exactly atomization. So I have in the book, the argument I make is that the result of rampant financialization of our everyday lives has been a disintegration of our traditional forms of community. The book, though, is hopeful. And my argument is that there is another story here. There is something else that is going on. And that is, there are forms of connection and collectivity that are being formed that don't look the way we expect them to look. There are forms of politics that don't look the way we expect them to look. And by that, so I look at some of those examples that I have in mind take place in virtual spaces. So I'm interested in virtual spaces of social encounter.
So cryptocurrency. No, I'm joking. But that's a great example of yeah. like the we're in, you know, the end times of the speculative marketplace. But keep going.
Totally. And I should say, when I was writing the book, the sort of explosion of crypto hadn't really happened like in earnest, like in the way that it has now. But absolutely, I mean, you know, there is actually, I do think that there is a very interesting social element in crypto communities. Again, we tend to see it on the regressive end of the spectrum, you know, mm-hmm. the crypto bros types, you know, the short selling in the events like the GameStop saga and so on, you know, like the Reddit kind of, you know, the QAnon elements within it. There is a whole bizarre sort of mix of regressive elements that come together, but mm-hmm. they do come together. And I think the point I want to make is that they don't only come together to make profit, you know, they don't just gamble. They're short selling or their crypto and NFT type of gambling isn't merely to in the chase of, you know, like their version of the American dream. You know, I mean, there is an element of being part of something bigger, of being part of a community, and of a community of contrarians as well. And there is an interesting collective element that I
love
think
that
is often...
I love that term, community of contrarians. It's true. I mean, and they're heavily irony-laden and also disconnected from everyone, but an in-group at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think that there is then also... but this is not the only type of connection. And I give some examples in the book of more progressive types of... coalescing groups that coalesce around this condition of uncertainty and around this more speculative way of acting. And so I don't know if you want me to bring some of those examples up now.
Sure. Or, go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, the one I love talking about is, again, one that I'm sure your viewers will be familiar with is the K-pop, this Korean pop band fandom communities. So these are teenagers all over the world. I mean, this is an extremely popular genre way beyond South Korea where it began. And so you have young folks there that connect with each other in very transient ways through TikTok mainly or Instagram or other such means. And they manage on in recent political events to intervene in fantastic and spectacular ways. And what I have in mind here, of course, is the coordinated sabotage of the Trump Tulsa, Oklahoma rally, right?
Yeah.
As you will remember, this was, you know, they managed to essentially have him speak in an empty stadium, right, mm-hmm. by selling, you know the story. They bought all those tickets with the intention of not showing up and so on. So that is a speculative act. You know, that is a kind of a speculative politics, a politics that embraces this kind of more chaotic and uncertain moment with the intention, though, of sabotaging the very regressive elements that are on the other side. And they're playing the same game. So it's the kind of politics that tries to beat the enemy, you know, in their own game. And I think there's something to be... something to learn from that and not to just dismiss it as flippant.
I agree. And I think that the left could be better at engaging in that way because there is, like, you know, that is in many ways some of the language that's being spoken online, even though, like, I'm relatively young and I feel like I've already aged out of it. But I do appreciate it for what it is. Well, really appreciate your time today, Aris. The book is called Speculative Communities Living with Uncertainty in a Financialized World. We'll put a link to this in the podcast description to the book and in YouTube and wherever you're listening to this and at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. All the
best. Of course. All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break, and then we will get to our second guest, Nathan Tankus, and we'll be talking about what the hell is going on with the Fed. back, and we are joined now by Nathan Tankis, publisher of the site Notes on the Crises and research director of the Modern Money Network. Notes on the Crises is really good. I would highly recommend it. We'll link to it as well in the show notes and at majority.fm. Nathan, thank you so much for coming on today.
Great to be here.
For sure. So let's start with the most basic question of all. What is wrong with the Fed?
What's wrong with the Fed? Well, I mean, at the most basic level, what is wrong with the Fed is that they've been tasked, they've been put in charge of running our whole economy, and they're not up to that challenge. They have the tools they have can do certain things very well, doesn't do other tools anywhere near as well, and, you know, kind of put me in, coach. We have a lot of different agencies that have a lot of other different capabilities, or that they could be given a lot of other different capabilities that could really do a better job together of managing the economy rather than having this one agency be in charge, being in charge of it.
What are the Fed's capacities? Because I know our audience will be familiar with the dual mandate, the fact that they are supposed to, in theory, maximize employment, but then also control prices and make sure that inflation doesn't get out of control. But one of those takes a lot more precedence over the other.
Yes. So at the most basic level, what the Fed is in charge of is interest rates. They set interest rates. They set short-term interest rates. And through their setting of short-term interest rates and some other tools, which maybe we could talk about, maybe not, they set longer-term interest rates. And that they use that tool to try to manage the economy. You know, in theory, it's kind of nice, simple process. You raise interest rates. You take demand out of the economy. You know, people's credit card bills are higher because they're paying higher, more interest. People's mortgages are higher because they pay more interest. Same for companies and so on. And they get demand out of the economy. You know, demand is supposed to be the main thing that drives inflation, at least in this story, rather than, say, supply chain issues, rather than corporate power, or any of the other kind of factors that you might point to. And through this nice kind of balancing, they, you know, have just enough demands to get employment to the right place to make sure that enough people have jobs, but without tipping things over and us having higher inflation. So the main thing is interest rates. And then there's a secondary thing where it's kind of responsible for the banking system. It provides liquidity to the banking system. It's making sure that we're not having big bank runs, or supposed to be making sure.
Right.
And so it has that secondary thing that's going on, which I'm sure we'll talk about at the end.
Yes, we will get to the SVP, the SVP example there. But I just wanted to touch on flesh that out a bit in terms of their usage of interest rate hikes and reducing them in order to manipulate the economy in theory. Like, they rely on this age-old connection between inflation and employment. What is your position on that thread that the Fed continues to connect despite a lot of evidence essentially saying that there is no connection?
Yeah, I mean, I think the core of that thread is that they assume away all the other different connections. I mean, if you go back to writings in 2020, especially in the context of the disruption of coronavirus, I mean, it was clear that coronavirus was stressing supply chains. Supply chains have still been stressed, and they, you know, there's been less stress recently, but we're still in a kind of very tight situation because we don't have the institutions to manage supply chains. Basically, we've abrogated having agencies really preemptively and proactively manage them. We haven't really invested anywhere near adequately in our ports in a generation. Mm-hmm. And bottlenecks especially at the Port of Los Angeles, reflect that lack of investment. And so they're sort of just an assumption, assuming away of all these other things, which the pandemic has really put to the forefront, just to focus on demand. And then demand, the focus, even that is kind of circumscribed. It's all about wages. It's all about wages going high, too high. You know, you might have some little thing happening from some other area, but we call that a shock. What isn't a shock is workers' wages going up, too little unemployment. And, you know, this will set off this process that's supposed to explode forever, where wages are accelerating forever, prices are accelerating forever. If we don't intervene at all, there'll be hyperinflation, you know, hyperinflation, inflation. It's all about wages, and everything else is sort of this side story that we kind of put to the side, say, oh, that's an exogenous, that's not to do, you know, that's something else's problem. That's not something we focus on. What we're focusing on is the problem of inflation, and the problem of inflation always just ends up being the problem of wages.
And which is insane, because we know that price gouging and COVID, the supply chain issues that you did just lay out there, were major drivers of this. But there's less evidence for the gouging. But the corporations understand that the Fed's mandate is like they're in second grade, right? In terms of how they can deal with economics. They have very few tools at their disposal. They're in elementary math, or they're reading very short sentences. But the economy's in like their senior year. And the Fed doesn't seem to have the updated capacity to deal with the complexities of the economy. And so all they know how to do, and because they're so intertwined with the banking, the big banks, which we can get into at some point, all they're incentivized to do is discipline labor. Like, my desire in the midst of the inflation crisis, or the panic over it, was to go after corporate price gouging. But that's so beyond the capacity of the Fed that it's unimaginable for them.
Yeah, and I think there's a few different layers to this. One is just the most basic layer. They don't have the tools, so they don't want to emphasize that. They've put in their mandate to have, as you said, maximum employment, price stability. All they have to do, all they have are their tools. And so if they emphasize these other things and say, well, we're not going to respond to this latest, you know, round of inflation because that's mainly about particularities in the housing market. That's mainly about supply chains. That's mainly about, you know, rising corporate profit margins, as former Vice Chair Lael Bernard talked about before she went over to the National Economic Council. Like, these kind of things, if they talk about it, they're essentially admitting, well, they can't do things about inflation, and they're not going to be responding to it. And that creates a whole panic in the business press of saying, you know, they're letting inflation happen. And they don't, and you know, they, for some good reasons and some more cynical reasons, don't trust any other agency to really respond to problems. But what this all comes to is essentially that we never build the kind of whole of government response that we need to inflation until it's too late. Until, oh, there's some recognition in a crisis, so they you start doing things, but the things they're doing is very ad hoc. Like, to respond to supply chain issues, that's something we should have been building from like 2011, 2012, and securing supply chains. That's not something you do after supply chains have enormous stresses on them and then try to fix things when right in the middle of the moment. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like trying to study for an exam while, you know, the exam's already been going on for an hour and you're showing up late because you wanted to study a little bit. It doesn't work. It doesn't make sense.
And how does the Fed's capacity compare to other central banks around the world? And I mean, like, the United States, it's obviously it's fiat currency. What we do is the trickle effect is felt everywhere in the world, but downstream from it. But like, what you're laying out here is just how limited the Fed's abilities are, and it seems like this is a flaw in the construction of it compared to the way that I would imagine other central banks are set up in other countries.
I would say actually it's kind of pretty similar. The central bank independence was proliferated from the United States. We have such a successful example of Volcker, you know, just crushed inflation here. Happened to have a whole big impact on everywhere else too, but let's ignore that. And you know, through things like the Washington Consensus and the IMF, like, part of those structural adjustment programs weren't just changing how, like, other things in the economy worked and changing how private sector institutions in those economies worked. It was also saying you should have an independent central bank and it should be structured like us. Mm. The European Central Bank has it's structured in treaty form, a kind of very strong form of central bank independence, which, as we've seen with the Eurozone crisis, and on other events more recently, has given the ECB enormous power, in some ways even more power than the Federal Reserve has, because, you know, it's structured by treaty. They'll have to negotiate an entire new treaty to change anything about how the ECB functions, and, you know, good luck to that possibility. Right. So I think this is actually a similar problem around the world. It's a little bit different because the United States is such an austere country that even if other places haven't been proactively having other agencies involved with managing inflation, they've, you know, for example, have been having more adequate investment in their ports and, you know, more adequate investment in their train systems, in their train transportation systems, less reliance on trucking. They've done, you know, just as kind of normal government operating procedure, they've done some of the investments that we've desperately lacking here. So in that sense, it's worse. But in terms of actively saying, no, you're a part of the inflation management process and, you know, we need each agency doing X, Y, Z thing, I think actually a lot of, not universally, obviously, you know, it could be a whole big discussion,
right,
but a lot of other countries are in a similar position to us as putting too much of the responsibility for inflation and employment onto the central bank.
So what is your position on where those other responsibilities should lie in the way that the U.S. government is structured?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing to start with is, so we have a Financial Stability Oversight Council that was created by the Dodd-Frank Act, which is an interagency group of many different agencies that are involved with financial stability coming together to look at sort of the bigger picture of financial stability. Now, that agency has a few specific things that are, or that interagency group has a few specific things that are problems with the way they're structured, with the way they should be restructured. But in general, in the big picture, I think that's a great idea and a great model for, say, a price stability oversight council.
Mm.
And that would be a great kind of starting point to get other agencies to think seriously about how their role in inflation management. You know, you're not going to get the Maritime Commission to be thinking about, we need to invest in ports to keep inflation down on its own. That's going to be something it's going to be doing in the context of, you know, a big room of people together talking about that from different agencies. And I think that's the first step. I mean, it's a huge task project to get a whole really true and permanent whole of government approach to managing the economy. But I think that is the first step to getting that conversation forward and getting many different agencies focused on that.
You also spoke about how the Fed is supposed to be overseeing banks, and take us through that role of theirs, and especially how that relates to what we saw around a month ago, I guess, at this point, with the collapse of those two regional, I say in quotes, giant banks that were redefined as regional under the Trump administration to allow them to take on more risk.
Yeah, I mean, in general, the Fed is also supposed to have a major role in financial regulation. It does not do this role very well. In practice, the Federal Reserve Board has technically been legally given this responsibility, but it delegates its role to the reserve banks. You know, the regional reserve banks, there are 12 of them. They have a president that is selected. That's a whole other conversation. But these like reserve bank presidents, the president and CEOs of essentially like a big company. It's a public company, but a big company nonetheless. They're paid $500,000 or sometimes even more than that. And in for example, the New York Fed. And it's just they were involved with so many responsibilities that it's really like pick and choose which of those reserve banks take their regulatory role seriously, which means, you know, the kind of neglect of that role goes downhill. And this has been a huge issue. It's a huge issue for decades. There was a commission run by then Vice President George H.W. Bush, which was going to recommend completely taking regulatory supervisory authority from the Federal Reserve, give it to other agencies. That was killed at the last minute. It's been a recurrent problem that they're not very good regulators. Timothy Geithner very famously said that when he was at the New York Fed, he quote unquote wasn't a regulator. Mm. And that was not true. But that attitude of basically people being so neglectful of the role that they don't even think of themselves as regulators at all, it kind of permeates the history of this institution. And we almost took away all that power from the Fed, that supervisory power. And I think taking that power away from the Fed, it should be under consideration again, especially for the institutions that aren't the largest institutions and thus don't have the specific Dodd-Frank rules involve them. Whether or not we extend the Dodd-Frank rules to banks that would be the size of Silicon Valley Bank, which of course has been a big discussion.
Yeah, I mean, and if you don't mind speaking a bit more about the Fed and their response there, because I think a lot of people were confused when Janet Yellen said, hey, we're going to make depositors whole, but don't worry, it's not coming out of the taxpayers' pockets. And so that was like the Treasury and the Fed working together on this front. Explain to the audience what the heck even happened there.
Yeah, so what
don't mind.
This whole language of taxpayer money is a kind of, it's a dodge. It's not really a very coherent concept on its own. There's always public money involved when you have some government agency handing over public money. In this case, what effectively happened is the immediate thing that happened is this: the Federal Reserve lent those banks that were then now owned by the FDIC literally like $150 billion to cover the depositor outflow that they couldn't cover before the FDIC took them over. So that's the most basic thing that happened. And then at a certain point, some weeks later, the bank was sold at a $20 billion loss, a $20 billion loss that was a loss taken by the government. And that came out of the Depositor Insurance Fund, which is from the FDIC, but it's basically just like an accounting gimmick. It's just a line item that says, you know, how much have we paid out versus how much have we specifically collected from banks in these insurance assessments. But essentially, what that's kind of just detail that can be swept aside. What happened was first $150 billion were lent, and then ultimately $20 billion actually came from public money permanently, as in not a loan, just sort of this is what we're putting out there to backstop depositors and the losses that the bank took. I mean, that's the basic, you know,
right
now line is that you know, the public lost $20 billion in Silicon Valley Bank.
Yeah. I mean, and it just, to return to your other point about the Fed and its failure as a regulator, so much of this probably falls on the fact that Congress has been actively deregulating the banks statutorily over the past, I mean, really since the Clinton administration. There has Dodd-Frank, yes, was a bit of a better step in response to the crash. They had to do something, but it didn't go far enough. And so it's almost like the Fed is taking on more than it should, given its role, because it's forced to kind of fill the gaps of what should be a legislative regulatory framework that is passed on to other bodies that are well more equipped for this.
Yeah. I mean, I would say two things there. One is something that isn't really understood very well is that when Congress passes a law taking away regulatory authority from some agency, even if it's a specific set of authorities and not all of that authorities, there's an implicit message that banking regulators take from that, which is we're supposed to stay away from that. We're going to get in trouble with Congress. We're going to get punished if we focus on that. So no matter how much the deregulation that's happened, bank regulators take that as an even larger signal to not supervise banks, to desupervise, not focus on them. So deregulation bills are always even worse than they seem on the top end, because the message that regulators are getting is, it's a chilling effect. You're not supposed to be looking at them at all. It's the same thing as like having a meeting with the Keating Five over, you're not supposed to be regulating the Keating Five. You know, if you didn't have the kind of people like Bill Black who are then going to blow the whistle, the alternative is, well, we're not supposed to really be looking at any of these savings and loans, you know, because we're going to get pulled up in a congressional meeting and I'm just some random regulator. And here are some senators telling me that I'm not doing my job right. And that's an extreme example, but deregulation bills in general work that way, where there's just sort of a sense, whoa, okay, so we're not supposed to be supervising at all. On the second point about the Fed being given too much responsibility, I think that is true in the sense that, like, we shouldn't have so much power and responsibility concentrated in one institution. But one important thing to note about the Fed is that it has an unlimited operational budget. Mm-hmm. It can spend whatever amount of money that it needs to spend in order to carry out its responsibilities. So uniquely among government agencies, if they are having a difficult time supervising banks, they can hire more people at will. They can hire billions of dollars of worth more regulators. And even $500 million can be, every year, can be a huge difference at the regulatory level. So I ultimately agree that, you know, as I said, I think the supervisory responsibility should be taken from the Fed, but it should be recognized that they have unique ability to get boots on the ground, really taking these issues seriously, and they do not.
Yes. Well said. And for more, even more detail than I'm like kind of capable of grasping, you can go to Notes on the Crises, Nathan Tankus's website. You're a great writer on this. Great work over there. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate you coming on, Nathan.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yep, of course. All right, folks, well, with that, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program, head into the fun half. The number is 646-257-3920. We will take your calls, read your IMs. Also, go to shop.majorityreportradio.com. Pretty please? Well, if you'd like. There's some pretty cool t-shirts there, and they're only limited edition, the effing dork t-shirts. Sam was called an effing dork because Joe Rogan was too afraid to say his name, it seems like, on his show. Also too afraid to have him on. Curious. There you go. shop.majorityreportradio.com. Check it out. Limited edition. Get them while you can, everybody. All right, guys, we're going to head into the fun half. But first, ESVN yesterday. Bradley, or not yesterday, God, Jesus. I can't.
Monday.
I mean, I couldn't even think of the word cynicism in that interview. My brain is like, we're pretty fried right now. But
yesterday with David Cohen, you're like, I was gonna say something to you. You were, and me on Monday during ESPN, I literally was like, I'm thinking of a third Knicks player, and you were like, I think you're not thinking of.
Yeah, right.
That's like what you're doing. Like our brains are just on like a cast iron pan. Right.
Truly, truly, yeah. This is our brain on drugs, but not really. This is our brain on
graveyard shift. I mean,
skeleton crew Majority Report. Well, anyway, so on ESPN on Monday, we spoke about the NBA playoffs. The play-in kicked off last night. We gave our predictions. We were, you know, 1-for-2 as of those predictions. And we also spoke just about the odds to win the championship, who has the best odds, who I would take as a dark horse, but who we really think is actually going to make it to the finals. We also talked about how running backs should strike for better pay. In the NFL, as well as John Rahm's victory in the Masters, what that meant for the Saudi Golf League and the defectors who went there, and more. YouTube.com/ESVN show. And on Left Reckoning last night.
Yeah, Left Reckoning was on last night. David and Matt spoke with Paul Prescott, a Jacobin contributor, Teamsters for a Democratic Union organizer and former candidate for state senate in Pennsylvania, to talk about the legendary labor leader Tony Mazzacci. Then they were joined by Chip Gibbons, policy director of Defending Rights and Dissent, to talk about what we discussed in the first and before Aris joined us, the historic letter from squad members calling for the Biden administration to drop charges against Julian Assange. Mm. So YouTube.com/LeftReckoning for the show, and Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to access the post game.
Awesome. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this? anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Bring back DJ Denny.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denny.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Come on. Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.